Hello to people I haven't met before, and hello to people I have met before. Coincidentally, there are some people here who were at the Penrith Records Managers Conference last week, and I'm really pleased to see you again. I hope what I say is of interest to you. This is a great opportunity for me to address the records managers professionals through this conference. As you have heard from my introduction through John, I have a little bit of knowledge of records managers profession and their roles and responsibilities in ensuring good public administration. It was a new world to me until I was the WA Ombudsman, and as part of the Ombudsman's role I was also a member of the State Records Commission. In WA we had some problems with our record keeping, which led to Royal Commission, which led to some fairly prohibitive bans on yellow stickies. And that sort of decision making that none of us ever like to know exists. And the introduction of a very comprehensive State Records Act with quite comprehensive compliance requirements on every Director General and CEO in terms of a record keeping plan, an R&D schedule, all of these things that you probably know are your bread and butter. But that was a new regime for WA that was rolled out. The Commission comprised myself as Ombudsman, the Auditor General, the Information Commissioner in Western Australia, and an independent archives expert from one of the universities, John Curtin. And we reported directly to the Parliament. So I found that in Western Australia that gave State Records a strong, powerful, independent voice and a real authority. The State Records Authority operated in and of itself and reported through a minister to the Parliament, but if we as commissioners had any problems with how record keeping was unfolding in Western Australia, we had absolutely every right to report that to the Parliament and make comments and recommendations. So that was how I learned a little bit at least about record keeping. When I got the job of the inaugural New South Wales Information Commissioner, I was really pleased to see that I would be continuing what I'd learnt about state records in my previous job, and to encapsulate that with the Ombudsman duties I had, which were to ensure Parliament was confident in the machinery of government, in public administration, and also with my IT sort of 10 years in telecommunications, because that's the enabling platform on which to deliver information to the people of New South Wales. So all of those threads have come together really well for me in this job, and I'm very honoured and delighted to be here. From a personal perspective, it's really important that I engage with you as a group. I hope, as the Penrith group saw, it's very important that you understand the objectives of the Office of the Information Commissioner, that I tap into your expertise and your goodwill and your professionalism to ensure that the objectives of the Act are achieved. Fundamentally, the way you run business in your various agencies and offices allows the object of the new GIPA Act to be fulfilled. Access to records, and that allows transparency, enables review, is a fundamental prerequisite of an accountable system of government. So it's such an important plank, it's really one of the cornerstones of me doing my job well. So I'm hoping in my five-year term I will have a lot of opportunities to engage with you, to receive your feedback. I know I'll be working closely with the State Records Authority through Alan, through John. I'll be meeting with your board. You are a very important group for me, so I hope this is the start of a dialogue. So I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview to give you the legislative background. I hope it's of interest to you as a record keeper, but also as a citizen of New South Wales, to know what your rights are as well as what the responsibilities are that come from the changes to the FOI, now GIPA, regime. Good. People know that I'm bad at this. Oh, there we go. So that we've tried to keep this just to the headlines, and again, forgive me if you already know this, but I think it's worth recapping where are we today. So as of the 1st of July, the GIPA Act, the Government Information Public Access Act, replaced the old FOI Act. And the old FOI Act was very, very well entrenched here in New South Wales, but was it achieving its objectives? It was the view of the New South Wales Ombudsman that it was not. As you know, the intention of the FOI regime is to promote transparency and accountability, but unfortunately, and possibly you might have attested to this yourselves through your own professional experience, it tended if I'm generalising here, it tended to perhaps promote a behaviour which was more about what can we keep out? More of the first question being a defensive question rather than a proactive release question. That wasn't unique to us. It was a common experience in other environments where they have FOI regimes. Unfortunately, for many people, the default position is let's protect, let's just make sure we don't embarrass ourselves, let's keep it close. The GIPA Act and the GIPA regime and this similar regime in Queensland, the similar regime at the Commonwealth level, the similar regime in the UK, similar regime in New Zealand are all about reversing that fundamental precept. The fundamental driver of GIPA is that everything is open unless there is a very, very, very strong public interest reason for it not to be. It's a complete reversal from the way we operated under FOI. So the aim of the Act, and the Act is very clear about its policy object, the aim is to open government information to the public through a proactive release of government information by agencies. Proactive is a really, really key descriptor. Proactive means we will do it without asking. We will think. We will be service oriented. We will be putting information out there in the public interest to tell citizens the business that we're in, how we're going, what our policies, what our decision-making frameworks are, what our performance metrics are, what we report to the Parliament about. We will be proactive in telling our story as individual government agencies to the citizens of New South Wales. Another really important thing that happens under this Act is that it gives citizens an enforceable right for them to access government information. And this is a strong part of my message as the new Information Commissioner. It's now a rights discussion. Citizens have a right to government information. After all, as taxpayers, it's their information. You know, that's the ultimate accountability, really, of all of us as servants in the public sector. So citizens have a right to government information. And for that to be a meaningful right, access has to be simple, has to be efficient, has to be effective. But citizens have a right. So part of my message, I'll be doing a roadshow later on in August and September where I'll go to regional New South Wales. I'm meeting with community groups. I'm meeting with the sort of citizens advisory type people who will help citizens activate their rights to let them know this is the case. And there is only a restriction where there's an overriding public interest against disclosure. So the default position is it's in the public interest to talk about what we're doing, only unless there's an overriding. And I'll give you some more details about that afterwards. And the bottom line is that formal applications, which were the bread and butter of the old FOI regime, the $30, all of that sort of stuff, are meant to be a last resort. So when I'm looking at the bell curve of the information that goes out to the citizens of New South Wales, I will expect to see at that tiny tail end the applications, the formal application process. We are meant to be seizing the opportunity to communicate better with the people of New South Wales about our business as government agencies. Oh. So where do we fit in? The Office of the Information Commissioner is a new gig. It's part of the new right to information system. As I alluded to earlier, it is consistent with what's happened in other jurisdictions where they've gone through the same sort of policy thinking and the same revolution, because it is pretty revolutionary. It is such a reversal in our fundamental approach. So in Queensland, there's a right to information commissioner. At the Commonwealth level in November, there will be an information commissioner appointed with a privacy commissioner and an FOI commissioner. It's been around in New Zealand for quite a while. I don't know whether this is your experience, but I often find that New Zealand is very often a leader in public administration. Ombudsman, for example, they had ombudsman in the 60s. Australia didn't have ombudsman until the 70s. Very often New Zealand is a leader. So New Zealand has it pretty well established, and it exists in Queensland, Tassie. So Tasmania started the same day I started, the 1st of July. Curiously enough, I'm a Victorian, curiously enough, Victoria hasn't decided it needs one. But Victoria is a bit unusual, as I'm sure you will observe. I think we're only just starting to think about a corruption commission in Victoria. That's because we're really good there. We don't do anything wrong. There very odd, and South Australia, it's not on their agenda, but pretty well everyone else is thinking about it. So it's always reassuring for you to know that we're part of not just a national, but a far broader movement. This is happening more broadly, and I'm sure you'll understand why. So I've got a particular role. My role is very clearly articulated in my act, and I like to say that I'm very lucky. I have a very clear act. It's lovely. The newer acts are the crisper and clearer and less ambiguous they are, so I'm very lucky. I'm not as familiar with the State Records Act of New South Wales as I should be and as I will become, and I don't know how lovely your act is, but I'm really happy with my act. And my act tells me very, very clearly what I am accountable for, what I have to deliver. You know, what's my mandate? And my mandate is, first of all, to promote. And that's my first verb. I'm always interested in what are my verbs, what are my doing words, what am I meant to do? So my first verb is to promote. Promote the object of the act, promote awareness of the act to agencies, to citizens of New South Wales, to state-owned corporations, to universities, to ministers, all of whom are covered by the Act, all of whom fall under the requirements and the obligations of the Act. So I need to promote the Act and public awareness and understanding in the right to information system. My second verb is to assist. And as an ex-teacher, I love assisting. This is about helping people grow and learn. Our role as the OIC is to help them, pardon me, to help agencies understand the Act and comply with the Act. So we have a very, very important function where, again, and hopefully part of this is my assist function, where I talk to people who have to use it, who have to make it real, who have to make it simple, who have to make it work in their organisations. We have to help agencies understand what the Act's about and how to make it work. We have, and under that we have training, we produce products, we've done some guides, all of the standard things, but hopefully we'll also be able to be a bit more creative in the way we assist. And I think Addis Penrith, if I could use that as an example, a problem was raised that was particularly important to the local government records managers around copyright, and the creative group solution to that is we'll get a round table together and we'll talk. And we've already started work on that with legal advice, because we understand there's different legal advice about how you treat copyright under this regime. That sort of creative problem solving hopefully will be how we assist. We also have the review function. So review, which is about the last dot point, receive and deal with complaints about anything covered under the Act and reviews of agency decisions. So that's my complaint handling function. We've already got our first complaints. We've already got the first applications at the Administrative Decisions Tribunal where we'll have an interest, so there's already a pent-up demand. When you think about who uses or used FOI and who's likely to be big users of the GIPA Act, the obvious candidates are, especially at the current time, opposition politicians, the media, and really the largest third group is people who are after personal information about themselves. So I mean, we pretty well know who wants to use the Act as it stood under FOI. So we should be on the front foot about being prepared for that, particularly now, and that's going to ramp up, isn't it? There's no doubt that scrutiny by the media of government decision making, policy outcomes, etc. I mean, we see it every day in the newspapers. That's going to get stronger. So they're the people who use the Act, and those people will start complaining to us when they don't get the information quickly and simply and cost effectively. And we'll have the power to review those decisions. So that's the complaint handling function and the sort of compliance monitoring function, where we will go into agencies either in response to a complaint because we've seen a pattern of complaints, if there's a systemic issue, or because of a bit of intelligence that we might have picked up. And again, I used the example with Penrith, where I heard a keen young person from a government agency say, "Whoa, since you've been appointed, the shredders have been running hot." So I went, "Okay, I know where you work, and I'm going to be really interested to see what your organisation's doing." So, you know, there will be those sort of subtle things. So as an independent person, I report to the Parliament, a joint committee of the Parliament, so a minister can't tell me what to do. So I have a fair bit of freedom, and I need to use my powers wisely. And finally, we've got a feedback I've got a feedback verb, and the purpose of that is to provide feedback to the Parliament about how the Act is going, about how agencies are tracking, about whether the policy object is being achieved, about whether there are things that should be changed. So again, my engagement with you and with similar groups, with people who do the IT in organisations, with the records managers, with the FOI privacy officers in agencies, they will be people who will be able to tell me how is it really going, because you know on the ground exactly what the day-to-day implications are. So I've got that obligation, and I will report to Parliament on feedback. If I see any major sort of systemic failures in sectors, in specific areas, I will also report on those. And that will be public, that will be tabled in Parliament, and that is quite a powerful part of my armoury. I have quite strong powers under my Government Information Commissioner Act, similar to the powers I had as Ombudsman, the right to enter premises, the right to demand documents, so quite strong Royal Commission type powers, and they will be exercised with great discretion. And it's really important that you have both the proactive, promote and assist, and then the perhaps enforcement arm, review, feedback, to make the whole thing work. It would not, although I'm a bit of an idealist, it wouldn't just work if I was here to promote and assist. You would give me a bit of airtime and then you would get on with your core business. But I have the other side, and that's a really important part of the commitment, the policy commitment to this working well. Now, the aims of the reforms, and I'm going to keep echoing these messages every time I speak to agencies and people involved in agencies. For me, the mantra around an effective outcome for GIPA is, from a citizen's perspective, or from your perspective, I have to make the Act real. From a citizen's perspective, I have to make it simple. If not, we won't be achieving our objectives. So simple and streamlined access to information has to be the foundation. And you can see where your role is so important there, because if people don't know what information they have, if it's poorly classified, if it's poorly stored, if it's all over the shop, if it's in people's bottom drawers because it's a bit sensitive, we're not going to be able to fulfil that part of the Act. This is really fundamental records manager's business. The broader, the higher order aim of the Act, and one that really excites me and that I'm very passionate about, because I know it will be beneficial to all of us citizens in a democracy, is that it can promote open discussion and contribute to public debate. And I don't know if anyone else is as old as me, but when I look at how much the world has moved over the past 3 or 4 decades in terms of citizens' access, consumer empowerment, because I've had a long time in consumer complaints, more and more, if you think about your own interactions as citizen or as a consumer, it's as if we have an insatiable appetite for information, whether it's about cooking or whether it's about Julia Gillard's hair. It's all crazy, but isn't it? You just can't get enough. And you look at how much published material is out there, and you look at the web, and you look at the generation who will follow us, and you look at their expectations of access to information. It's an inevitable, it's just a juggernaut, and we have to cope with that as governments, government agencies delivering services to citizens. So the theory is, the better informed you are, the better you can contribute to the development of policy. And any of you who have been active at a local level in planning issues or heritage issues or bike path issues or anything that's of interest to you as a citizen, as a user of government services, you'll know you want good information so you can contribute to the policy development, make it open and transparent, understand the reasons, even if you don't always agree, understand the reasons for decisions, and maybe live with the outcome, or maybe work on changing it so that down the track. But it allows us, if we choose, to be engaged as citizens. And this is part of the perceived benefit of this regime, and that's why it's linked to that rights regime, and that's why it's happening in so many jurisdictions. It enhances government accountability, and that's really a no-brainer, isn't it? I mean, the more visibility you have of decision-making processes, of how governments use resources, of how decisions are made, the more sunlight is shone on those, and as everyone, especially the anti-corruption people, say sunlight's the best disinfectant. There's nothing better than just opening things to the light. All of a sudden you think before you write, all of a sudden you think before you make that decision or jump in on behalf of your mate or whatever what might be the risk if it's hidden. So it enhances accountability. It informs the public about the operations of agencies. One of the big things I had to do as an ombudsman was to enhance public confidence in the machinery of government. And lack of confidence leads to conspiracy theories, we've seen conspiracy theories, it leads to a defensive and a confrontational and a difficult communication relationship, and an openness and better information can perhaps minimise some of that potential for conflict. It ensures effective oversight of public funds, and for someone like the Auditor General, this is the key issue. You know, show me the money, where's it gone? Has it been spent? Is it being spent appropriately? It does allow that because it opens up information to public scrutiny. And at the bottom end, the really pointy end of this, which is where the anti-corruption type agencies or the New South Wales Ombudsman would really look, it can reveal or substantiate misconduct, negligent, improper or unlawful conduct. And you know again that records are fundamental to an oversight agency's scrutiny of actions and decisions. So we come back to government information itself, because it's always important to define your key terms. New South Wales chose to call its act the Government Information Public Access Act because it wanted to make clear that this only regulates government information, that it wasn't about private sector information, whereas some people get a bit confused. So it's clearly about government information. That's the target of the act. And it's information contained in a record held by a government agency. That's you. That's you. It also includes information held by private sector agencies with whom government agencies contract over a certain dollar amount. And again, in the 21st century, that is going to become more and more and more a feature of our lives. What do our contractors who are delivering services on our behalf, how do they account for their money? How do they spend their money? Where does the money go? Again, to use that Auditor General term of follow the money. That's not always palatable to some organisations. Organisations, and I've heard of a few large corporates, really multinationals, who have a problem with our regime. Now, that's understandable if they're in Australia and they're doing business across a range of states and with the Commonwealth. You want to, from a business efficiency perspective, ensure that we don't set up our own little sort of subsets or crazy interpretations of our act. So one of my objectives is to ensure there's sort of an overall harmonisation at the Commonwealth and the state level, because people will want to do businesses with us and they will not want these sorts of burdens of regulatory compliance obligations to impede business efficiency. So that's an interesting dimension. And all government agencies, as I said, include state government departments, ministers and their staff. And that's a really important one, explicitly. Some regimes don't cover ministers, ours does. Public authorities, public offices, local authorities, courts, universities. So anybody basically who's using public money for a public purpose. So we're all caught. And when I'm talking to the general public about, you know, I said keep it real, make it simple, almost the starting point for most people, the default position for most people is that I will look on the website. Isn't it? We do that as consumers. We as citizens more and more go to the government website to find out information. So that's a really important starting point for many agencies. Now, I've been interested in some discussions I've had with certain agencies about how they're going to implement GIPR, and one fairly large one that has a high volume of transactions with the public is taking the opportunity of this new regime to revisit all of their communications with the public. And I think that's a very good outcome, because that means that they are service oriented. They're thinking, what does the public want to know about us? What data do they want to use? What information do they want to have so that they can have happy and meaningful lives, or get the right train or catch the right ferry, whatever. That sort of approach. And that's a really good cultural approach, because it's about what's the business I'm in, what service do I offer, and how can I make it really meaningful. So agency websites are really important. Of course, I acknowledge that there will be some very small organisations who don't really have a lot of facilities or capacity to put a lot of information on their website. We have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. But the default position is your website. The Commonwealth Ombudsman, or the Commonwealth Information Commissioner, said on Friday at an admin law seminar that at the Commonwealth level, 70% of citizens' transactions are online, moving to 90%. that would probably be, and I'm trying to understand that, but I imagine it would be Centrelink, would be the tax office, it would be all of those, immigration, all of those areas where there are a multiplicity of transactions, and then increasingly on the web. I asked our government chief information officer yesterday what would we estimate for New South Wales. He said it wouldn't be that high, it would probably be under 50%. But when you think about the rail corps and you think about, you know, those people who have high volume transactions of information, you know, most of us, we will look up the timetable, most of us. We will look up maybe the local government development applications if they affect us because they're next door. So we will engage as citizens with agencies through the website. So that's a really important starting point. And for you from your digital, you know, record perspective, that's key. We ask, or at least we say to people, ask, and there's nothing better than asking, because often there's an answer. It's easy to say, I can't find it, oh, they're hopeless, so I'm just going to complain. It's much better if we emphasise to citizens that this is an engagement process, it's two-way. If I'd like something, let me give the agency the opportunity to meet my needs, might be there. And then the agency makes some decisions itself about whether the information is open access or mandatory, and that's prescribed in the Act. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be out there anyway, just no discretion. Whether it should be made available as part of a proactive release. If I give you an example there, I spoke with an agency yesterday who said they were scrutinising all their FOI applications for the past 5 years, identifying patterns and putting common information up on the web. Good on them. What a smart thing to do. You know, why wait and be asked and be asked and be asked and be asked? Why not just put it out there? So that sort of proactive analysis is a really smart way to respond, and it's going to save you time and effort in the long run if there is clearly a citizen's need for a particular type of information. Can it be disclosed through informal release? There's an encouragement there that, again, in the interest of making it simple and easy for citizens, we talk with them about what they need, and if we can make it available, we do. You know, and then as a last resort, go through the formal access application process. So is any information not accessible? That's always an interesting question to people, and the answer under this regime I think is a lot simpler than under the old FOI regime. If there is an overriding public interest against disclosure, then the answer is yes. And that's the only test. Now there are some categories of information in the schedule to the Act. I'm not going to go through that exhaustively, but the examples I think are obvious: cabinet deliberations, sensitive personal or commercial in confidence information, information that could jeopardise public safety. So there's a list of criteria there for the sorts of information that could be seen as in the public interest not to be released. Nevertheless, agencies still have a discretion if they choose to make some of this information available. Well, we haven't seen any examples of that yet. But public interest is always the touchstone. Is it in the public interest that this information go out? And the fact, and this is really important because this is actually named in the GIPR Act, the fact that disclosure might cause embarrassment to or loss of confidence in the government is irrelevant and must not be taken into account. And that's a very powerful thing. So clearly when I talk about who are my key stakeholders, talking to ministers, talking to opposition members of parliament, particularly talking to their advisers who often have to wear and advise them on these sorts of issues, and we've done that comprehensively, that's really important that we continue that dialogue. And if someone doesn't get access, then they can make a formal access application, and there are rules around what a formal access application looks like, and we've got samples on our website. It has to be in writing, it has to say that it's under the GIPR Act. You know, so these are, for whatever reason, these are the rules in the Act, and so what we've done is, and it's important if I stop on the second last dot point there, provide enough information to help the agency identify the information. One of the really important things in this process is that it provides a greater opportunity for engagement with the citizens who may be your clients, and you know, it helps them define their needs. You really need them to also think to help you. You don't need people to go, oh, look, I want everything that was ever written about my street from 1969 to 2009. You know, man, my God, where would you go? So why? Help them understand and name. You can't take into account motive for asking information, but you can help people define their information requests so that it helps the agency deliver and the person be satisfied. And that is not a bad thing, for people to engage with clients and try and help them understand the information and what they want to use it for. As I said, the formal, and it's a strong message from me to agencies, the formal access application is meant to be last resort. So over the long term, I'm expecting to see a decline in the number of formal access applications. And I think citizens have a right to expect a decline in formal access applications because they are bureaucratic, they are rule bound, and they are not easy and simple. So, and these things are being named. It's really interesting that some people haven't yet thought of them, so it's worth naming them. So some agencies haven't already thought, is the information already publicly available? I've actually seen examples where people make people go through hoops to get stuff that's in the public domain, whereas what they could have said was, just two clicks away on the website, you'll find the answer. You know, and that's not a service culture. So part of the rules here are going to help us promote more of a service culture, because they're going to stop that, no, it's too hard, you know, that really narrow mindset, and make it more service oriented. If it's personal information, of course people have a right to their personal information. I should stop and make a point there that the privacy rights and the access rights can create attention. And they're really important that they be both factored into decisions that agencies make about release of information. And interestingly enough, you may be aware that the government has a bill before Parliament that the Office of the Information Commissioner and the Privacy Commissioner come under one umbrella, which is the Office of the Information and Privacy Commission, OOS, something like that, IPC. Anyway, both of us together, which is what's happened in Queensland, what's happening at the Commonwealth. And the thinking there is that there will be times when we have to balance those rights, when we have to make decisions where a privacy right might become, might tip the balance in the public interest, where it might be more important to protect the privacy of an individual than to release information publicly. An example I gave at Penrith applies to local councils, where the first guideline I've issued under the Act talks about the pecuniary interests register for local government officials and delegates. I've made a guideline there where I've said that I believe that that information under the Act should have gone on the websites. And my decision was that the privacy rights of the individuals was a greater public interest right than putting that information on the website. So the information will still be viewable in local councils, as it should be, as part of the transparency and accountability regime. But putting it on the website, in my estimation, perhaps opened that person to identity theft, to some sort of breaches of their privacy, and I think that's a greater, higher order objective. So anyway, if the information can be released informally, if it's about the person's personal information, those sort of things mean give it to them, you know, really, give it to them. And then think about is it sensitive? Is the scope of the request so broad that it's going to take you a really long time? And you do see those applications. Again, something I've learned since taking on this job is that there's a small group of people who really like a large amount of information on a regular basis, and that's, I know, onerous and time consuming and blood pressure fluctuating causing for certain agencies who have these sorts of customers. And there are opportunities in the Act for us to put in place guidelines around what could be seen as vexatious or unreasonable complainant behaviour. Anyway, it's got to be a reasonable request to the extent that you can negotiate it, and is there some requirement to consult with third parties? So, you know, the things who people have been operating under the old FOI regime, these are not dissimilar, and if that's the case, you may need to go through a formal process. And then there are time frames. I'm mindful of time, and I gather, John, that this will be in our pack anyway, won't it? Would you like me to start wrapping up? Because I'm happy to. Another 5 minutes, all right. Well, I'll gallop through, and I'm sorry about that time. So you've got, again, timeframes that are pretty common across all the jurisdictions, 20 working days, extensions, deferrals. All of this is just about good basic public administration. Here's my timeframe. This is when you can expect the information. If there's going to be a delay, I'll tell you. And I'll give you reasons. All basic good public administration. There's no decision within 20 days. You consider it refused. It's quite citizen focused in the sense that the application fee must be refunded and the person has a right to review. And there are some the fees and charges regime is too hard to encapsulate in a 2 or 3 minute presentation, but we're putting quite a little comprehensive knowledge update fact sheet on our website today, I think, to summarise the fees and charges regime so that you can have a look at that, because there are quite a few variations. So if someone has been refused access to information, they can have an internal review in the organisation itself, they can ask for the information commissioner to review the decision, or they can go to the administrative decisions tribunal. And that, again, is good for citizens. It gives them a range of options. Some other information commissioners have determinative powers like a tribunal. I don't, and I think that's not a bad thing. So it gives the person who's unhappy with the decision a range of options through which they can that they can choose to take. And where can I get more information? I'd like to plug our website. It's really important that I get your feedback about whether the material we give you is useful, whether there are extra things we can do to make your life easier, whether there are FAQs that we can address, or other sorts of information we can provide. One thing we've done at the request of agencies is to send out a little button. It looks like the OIC button down the bottom, like our logo, which is an information, just an eye information button. And really good agencies have their access to information, one click away or maybe two. That's a real good test for me. How easy is it to find the information about the agency and what's the pathway? We've been getting a lot of calls from members of the public about their right to information, so the expectations of the community are rising. And my expectation is that agencies have done and are doing right now quite a bit of work to get ready for this regime, or to bed it down, and that after the first year, when we've gone through whatever teething troubles we go through, that it should be a fair bit smoother, and that citizens should really start to see and experience a difference in the information they can gain and the interaction they have with their government agency. So I'll stop there, I think, with a minute to spare. Do you want me to answer any questions, John, or just otherwise I'm around? Yeah, can I take any questions? But otherwise I'll be around at morning tea if anybody wants to ask me anything. Sir? Yes? Okay, so it's about enforcement and penalties. There are offence provisions in the Act, which is really significant. So there are penalty units for offences. I also have a specific reference in the Public Interest Disclosures Act, so somebody can make a public interest disclosure to me as the Information Commissioner about anybody who's breaching the provisions of the GIPA Act. So in fact there are quite strong provisions. It is an offence to stop, and I'm just paraphrasing here, to prevent somebody from releasing information that they should properly release under the GIPA Act. It's an offence. It's a serious offence. When my staff briefed the minister's advisers, everyone wrote that down. It's really important that people understand there are consequences if you don't take the Act seriously. So to generalise, without going into the detail, there are really strong provisions there to ensure effective enforcement action if I discover a breach, and that I'm very happy with. Yes. So to make them change their practices, for example, what compulsive pay? So my powers would extend to, for example, tabling a report in Parliament, as the Ombudsman does, about the activities of a certain agency. And I've always found I've always found that's been a very efficacious way of changing agency behaviour. It will depend on what sort of examples I see, but what I've used effectively as an ombudsman is, first of all, to table my special report about an agency's maladministration, then, with the minister's agreement, to engage on an annual review and another report to be named if it doesn't happen. You know, so usually I've found, working with the Parliament fairly inefficiently, I've been able to get significant changes to behaviour that is contrary to law. So is that all right as a general answer? Thank you for that question. Any other questions? Yes. Yes. Yes, the compliance regime, so the information's on the website. It's important that people understand what the compliance monitoring regime will be. So my first letter to Directors General was to say, I have a compliance monitoring function and this is what I'm going to do. And I think that's procedurally fair. I think people need to know how I'm going to judge them. So we've devised three levels of compliance monitoring. I've written to the Directors General saying, we'll be doing proactive audits, sort of self-assessment audits with you, hand by hand to help you. And we've done a compliance guide and a compliance checklist. So that's the assist and promote function. Then I've got my second order, which could be I may come in response to a complaint. And then my third order, which could be using that systemic feedback report to Parliament power. We need to devise some criteria in consultation, I think, with key stakeholders about what's the citizens' experience, what will they judge an effective regime, as well as agency compliance. But anyway, so our initial approach has been named, is out there, has been informed to all Directors General, and we will see how that goes. But thanks for that question. All right, is that okay, John? We've done our questions. One more question? No more questions? Okay.